Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what drives destructive or unethical foreign policies? Some point to pathological beliefs in pursuits of exceptionalism, honor, and glory. Others point to systemic flaws. What are the consequences? Then, what is the celebrity industrial complex, and how does it impact our democracy, our culture, and our society? We are speaking with Chris Fettweiss. He is a professor at Tulane University, and he studies political psychology and exceptionalism that drives nations to do stupid things. He presented at the APSA conference, and we're going to talk about what he has found in terms of the United States. Let's start with exceptionalism that you said drives countries to do things that are not so smart.
Every country feels exceptional in a lot of ways. The smallest country feels their culture is the best and they have figured everything out and everyone should adopt their ways. But a lot of people think America is exceptional in its exceptionalism, that we really think we have it figured out. And also we have greater power than most countries, so our exceptionalism allows us to do stupider things than other countries. Albanian exceptionalism isn't too dangerous to the rest of the world.
Talk about how this exceptionalism is articulated and then how it manifests itself in foreign policy.
One of the things it does is leads to hubris, what the ancient Greeks used to talk about, excessive self-love and self-confidence. And it leads us to overestimate the capabilities that we have, that we think things that are impossible are just difficult, and anything is possible if we put our minds to it. It's the American way. We can do it. And it's an optimistic, good aspect of our national character, but it can lead to bad outcomes. Things like nation building in Afghanistan, for instance. We think it's just difficult. If we put our minds to it, we'll be able to do it, rather than what a cool-headed analysis might say, that this is going to be impossible. It also leads us to not really understand others, understand how others are going to react to what we do or how they're thinking. So we are constantly surprised, repeatedly surprised, when others don't react to our actions in the ways we think they're going to.
You argued that this is actually pathological.
Yeah, and pathological in the sense that it can be counterproductive. It leads to dumb things. It's part of a basket of different emotions or motivations that lead us to do stupid things. Like, we fear much more than other countries do. And I talk also about honor and glory, but hubris, this excessive self-image, leads us to do pathologically counterproductive actions.
I'm guessing you think the Iraq invasion would be one of those.
That's one of the prime stupid things that we've done. And a lot of my work is trying to figure out why exactly we did it. There's a lot of different theories out there, from neoconservative cabal to getting oil. I think it's just people made a fairly stupid decision because of beliefs that they brought into the decision.
So maybe while all these other factors may have come into play, say the oil or the neoconservatism or there's even the psychological issue with Bush and his father and all of that, maybe they are all present and it just takes this hubris, as you call it, to believe that they're going to be able to be successful.
Yeah, we underestimated the costs of what Iraq was likely to be. We also didn't understand how the Iraqis were likely to react. It turns out we were surprised they didn't like being conquered. And that came as a surprise to a lot of us. The people who were supporting the war were fairly flabbergasted by what came next, which has been 3 solid years of civil war and then simmering violence since. And that took us by surprise. It was a decision based on a set of beliefs that were pathologically incorrect, that we are in tremendous danger, for instance, and we had to get Saddam Hussein because somehow he was threatening the United States. That's crazy.
So that's really kind of more of a fear issue than a hubris issue.
Yeah, that's fear. They all come together, and there's other factors, too, that you had mentioned. These complex events are rarely monocausal. They have a lot of different factors going into them. But fear and hubris certainly played a role.
What about the honor and the glory that you were talking about?
Very few political scientists or political leaders today talk about honor, but they do worry a lot about credibility. And the credibility of the United States is at stake if we lose here, if we don't continue to fight. The way people talk about credibility today is much like most centuries have talked about honor. So it still matters, and it still leads us to do stupid things. Vietnam, for instance, you can't understand why we were in Vietnam without obsession with credibility of the United States and the credibility of our commitments. And there's a lot of political science evidence to suggest that credibility today doesn't help you in the events of tomorrow. If you think you're bolstering your credibility, but other people don't perceive it that way, they don't remember the last event to the extent that you think they will. When you do something to bolster your credibility, you're hoping it'll make future crises easier to handle. And that's usually not the case. So we do stupid things because of our credibility. And the glory part, today you can't have a president say, let's go attack the country for the glory of America. Luckily, Napoleon could do that, but President Obama can't do that. But he can talk about competitiveness. We're a competitive country. We want to be number one. We want to be the best, and by a lot of measures, we're the most competitive country. And worry obsessively about our prestige and national rank and status. Will China rise to be number one someday? What will the cost be? I think that that's a pathological concern to obsessively try to be the best. First of all, China's not rising in any real measurable way that can overtake the United States in a way that matters. And if we don't realize that being number one isn't maybe as important, we might do something stupid in the future to prevent China from being number one. Where in my circles, in security circles, when people talk about Chinese aircraft carriers, there's an element that freaks out, like the Chinese are going to hit the beach at San Diego and start working their way east. It's really not that much of a concern. And we're not in that much danger, and we shouldn't obsess about being number one and the glory that is the best. One of the big themes of all the Republicans is that President Obama doesn't love America sufficiently. He didn't wear a flag lapel pin for a few months into the first campaign. He doesn't love it enough. And they're going to outlove America and have people vote for him. And there's a certain part of the electorate likes that. They'll vote for the person who seems to love America more because we all sort of bask in the reflect glow. So if they're loving America, they love me too. And we're going to have decisions to make in the coming years about Iran and about China. And my hope is that we can make those decisions better by recognizing the pathological influences of fear, honor, glory, and hubris in what we usually do. If the wrong president comes into power or is surrounded by advisors who think we have to attack Iran because they're a threat, that would be, in my estimation, probably a really stupid decision. So hopefully we can prevent that from happening.
You mentioned that you also have looked at post-Iraq war. Mm-hmm. What did you find?
I talk in earlier work about what is likely to happen after Iraq. I said we're unlikely to have a victory or a defeat like on the battleship Missouri after World War II. There's unlikely to be a surrender. It's probably just going to be a petering out to low-level guerrilla war for a while, and we're going to have troops there probably for the rest of my lifetime. Maybe not in the same numbers we have today, but there'll be somebody there keeping an eye on al-Qaeda elements in Iraq. We've jammed our hand into a hornet's nest. And it's hard to rip it out without having the hornets spill out all over the place. So it was a much bigger operation than the original planners thought it would be. They thought we'd be greeted as liberators, people throwing flowers at us, so happy to be conquered. They couldn't get over it. Turns out they weren't. It turns out that we did the impossible. What seemed to be impossible made life in Iraq worse for the people of Iraq. It was bad under Saddam, but civil war is worse. And the hundreds of thousands, who knows how many casualties, how many people died. We made things worse, which was hard to do because Saddam was a bad guy. There's no doubt about that. Was he a threat to us? No. Was he a threat to his neighbors anymore? But he was a bad guy.
I'm curious if when you look across other nation states, ethnic groups, if you find this is comparable to other kind of pathologies, and if you found that it had any impact on the long-term well-being of a nation state, ethnic group.
A lot of people talk about Rome. And the fall of, say, the British Empire, a lot of it fueled by fear of whatever group was right over the frontier. The British kept expanding because as soon as they expanded, they found another threat. And these kinds of pathologies can lead to overexpansion, overextension. I don't think it's a big danger for the United States, really. I don't think we're going to collapse in any way, because what really took down Rome was not hubris, but the barbarians. There's no barbarians going to storm into Washington, D.C. and burn it down anytime soon, which tells you we shouldn't be as fearful as we are, number one. But we're also not in the same danger of collapsing to outside enemy barbarians. We may experience its relative decline over this coming century, but it's not likely to be violent, likely to get better even for Americans over the course of the next century. Nobody talks about that.
Even with climate change?
Climate change, it's changing slowly. We'll see. That's sort of out of my field. In my field, people worry whether that'll lead to war and conflict over resources. It's much easier to cooperate over water than fight over it. Mm-hmm. And oil, it's very difficult to get oil out of a territory that's under dispute. Usually, and this is the case in the Caspian, the North Sea, all over, and it'll probably be the case in the South China Sea, they'll cut deals. They'll be posturing in the beginning, muscle flexing, and then they'll cut a deal where everybody gets a piece. Because if you don't cut a deal, you don't get the oil.
A lot of people would argue that much of what's gone on in Africa have been fighting over natural resources and some multinational corporations going and exploiting those natural resources and labor. And then you've seen in the Middle East, for example, a lot of warring over water, where the line goes, so who has access to the water.
in Africa, certainly, is by these sort of criminal gangs in West Africa and in the Congo that try to gain control of mineral-rich territory. There's been talk about water wars in the Middle East since I was a teenager, but they found ways to cooperate because if they don't, over the Nile or in the Levant, or if they don't figure out ways to come to agreements, then no one's going to be able to use the water. It's easy enough to prevent that from happening, to blow dams and or poison wells. It's so far, and I think there's a reason to be optimistic, that over natural resources, it's better to cut deals than fight for them. And I think most leaders in the end realize that. They'll posture and threaten, but they're not going to fight. And they get Caspian Sea. You know, throughout the 90s, people said there's going to be war because they'll never be able to figure out how to cut up the Caspian Sea and share those resources. And there was some muscle flexing occasionally, but they now have deals and the oil's flowing out of there. And what's likely to happen, I think, with water resources is, as the climate evolves, and oil too.
I think this was you that said this about how this was actually a more peaceful time than before. And I was recalling scholars calling the 20th century the mass murder century. So I was trying to reconcile the difference there between the way you saw it and if you were just an eternal optimist or if there were real numbers to measure this out.
There's a lot of real numbers, especially since the end of the Cold War. There's a few operations, outfits that measure and count wars. They all find that the number and intensity of wars has dropped steadily since the end of the Cold War. Nobody notices this. Internal wars, external wars, interstate wars, civil wars, ethnic conflicts.
Because we've had two essential genocides since then, too. I mean, Bosnia and Rwanda. Mm-hmm.
If you go back throughout history and measure the wars and the genocides, the major human rights violations, they're less frequent than they used to be. They still happen. There's still problems. I'm not saying there's not going to be trouble in the future. But there's less trouble with far more people than ever before. There's far fewer wars that happen now. There's no war going on in the entire Western Hemisphere except Colombia's got a civil war going on, but it's half the size it was 10 years ago. The entire Pacific Rim, all of Europe, completely at peace. But they just focus on the bad things, the potential for war. And Africa is a more peaceful place than any time we have in recorded history about it. It doesn't seem that way, because everybody knows about the Congo. It's still simmering in some places. West Africa is calm, which is hardly ever in history that there's no somebody's not killing somebody in West Africa. And maybe it's a temporary phenomenon in a few hours. When we get done with this interview, all hell's broken loose everywhere. But for now, it's peaceful. Nobody notices or cares when you tell them. Because when you tell them this, they say, well, yeah, but what about, you know, global warming? What about AIDS? Well, you are. We got problems. And we, especially as the United States, shouldn't be afraid. Because we're in a system, a global system, that is becoming more peaceful. And there's a lot of discussion about why. And that's a different book of mine, about why it's happening. I think it's an evolution in ideas. Other people think other things. But maybe it'll reverse itself. Maybe not.
Does the outfit that counts wars include all of the, you know, the United States helping the Libyan?
Yeah, that would count. Nowadays, there's one outfit that says once a war has started, they keep counting it if it's 25 casualties a year. 25 casualties a year is a month in New Orleans. Most people who count, say, 1,000 battle deaths a year, you got a war going on. And by that standard, Libya counts, but it's hard to tell how many people have died. The Russia-Georgia business does not, 800 or so. People died. Even if you ratchet it down a bit, the numbers of wars are historically low because in the past, there was a lot more. There have been a lot more than were counted originally because during the Cold War, there was fighting everywhere constantly. And now, I mean, think of the numbers of wars that happened in the Western Hemisphere alone. Now they're all settled except Colombia, and that's sort of now a trafficking war.
Thank you so much for being with us, Chris Fettweiss. Chris Fettweiss is a professor at Tulane University, has two books out now and one forthcoming. What's the forthcoming one?
Called Pathologies of Power, Fear, Honor, Glory, and Hubris in U.S. Foreign Policy.
When we come back, what is the celebrity industrial complex? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We've long been warned about the power of the military-industrial complex. But is there a celebrity-industrial complex? What exactly is it, and how does it affect our lives, our society, and our politics? We have three experts with us. Joshua Gamson is professor of sociology at the University of San Francisco and the author of Claims to Fame, Celebrity in Contemporary America. David Marshall is also with us. He's chair of New Media, Communication, and Cultural Studies at Deakin University in Australia. He's the author of Celebrity and Power, Fame in Contemporary Culture, New Media Cultures, and The Celebrity Culture Reader. David Giles is with us. He is a professor of media psychology at the University of Winchester in the UK. He's author of Illusions of Immortality, A Psychology of Fame and Celebrity, and Psychology of the Media. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the three of you here with us. David Giles, I'd like to start with you before we go into the impacts of this, what people call the celebrity industrial complex. We should start with what exactly we mean when we say celebrity.
I think the first thing is to draw a distinction between common or garden fame and maybe not common or garden, but fame itself and celebrity. Which is something I've always been quite keen to make distinct, because the process by which one becomes famous, I think we can trace throughout history. We can also trace at different levels in society. So it's possible to become famous, in a sense, within a bounded community, like a school, for example. There's always one student who is, or several students, who are more famous than the other students. And the sense in which one can become famous for doing certain things, or by accident, or because they occupy a particular position in society, like a president or some sort of other monarchy or something like that. But celebrity itself seems to me to be something that's very much bound up with media. And although we can, in a McLuhanish sense, we can always identify a medium that spreads people's well-knownness and makes people famous under any conditions, I think the mass media intrinsically linked with celebrity. So it's really something that's very much a 20th century phenomenon.
So you would say it hasn't always been with us in terms of, I mean, we used to have monarchies and they were famous.
Well, they were famous, but they weren't celebrities in quite the same way as someone whose fame has been spread by mass media. And I think that's the distinction I would make, in the sense that the modern-day celebrity is someone who just very visible in the media, rather than necessarily someone who does anything particular, who's talked about for his or her achievements or deeds. Because of that, celebrities just multiplied to a kind of dizzying extent, whereby we have so many celebrities, we can't possibly know them all, and they're becoming harder and harder to function as common knowledge between people.
This is David Marshall. David's pretty accurate. Got to get used to two Davids here. What I would add to that is what I always say is the defining feature of what celebrity is, which is that we gain knowledge about actually maybe what they're not famous for. And the word I use is that they move into this extra textual area, which means that it's not necessarily what they've done. It's what they're doing maybe in their personal lives or in some other aspect. We have a lot of activism going on with celebrities, and that would be an example of them using, in a sense, their renown and moving it into some other realm. We've become increasingly comfortable with that over the last century, really. I think David also characterizes it as fairly media-centric, meaning that it emerged somehow out of the media. And quite a few people talk about that. Historically, there's something that has changed roughly from about the 18th century to now, which is that we begin to look at people differently. It may be that it's parasocial, which means that we're not as connected as we think we are to the group of people that we know. And it also has qualities that it isn't attached necessarily to the way that power was constructed in the past. So that's why monarchies are really interesting to look at, because they really identify a transformation from authentic power to ceremonial power. And they become, in a way, a pathway to understand the emergence of celebrity. If you look at English monarchy, in a way, in the 19th century, or as it emerges in the 20th century, and you look at it in the late 20th century, and you see how various royal houses, maybe not the Saudi one, embody a celebrity relationship to their nation and to culture more widely, and have less to do with other kinds of embodiment.
In other words, they don't have the kind of governance power that they did at one point, but they have power as a result of all the privilege that's bestowed upon them by being famous.
Yes, but it's translated, and this is the media element, it's translated into something beyond that, that becomes an organization, an economic organization, meaning that we sell magazines or online sites through this other element that we want to know a little bit about their past, a kind of pathway to the truthfulness of a being, a very famous being, and we get caught up in trying to work out what that is. And so as much as we produce, you know, fictional dramas, serializations of all sorts of things, films, we also produce an amazing sort of construction of narrative of that this is somehow closer to the truth of this being that we see on screen or that we watch in some other environment because we get into almost their intimate and home life. So a lot of what's happened in the last 200 years is directly via celebrity related to democracy. It's kind of a translation of democracy in a really bizarre and quite twisted way. It's a celebration of individuality, but it's a celebration of individuality that doesn't have the sense of being already ascribed that power before.
It's funny you would say that about the democratic element. As I looked at it, I thought it's almost contradictory to democracy because it contradicts the idea of every man and every woman being equal.
Yeah, and that's the bizarre sort of relationship to it. It's very much a kind of... Another way of thinking of it is very connected to a kind of consumer capitalism relationship to democracy, which is that it's highly individualized, but it also privileges the idea that any individual can achieve, even if it's mythic, can achieve the notion of being significant. And that's the democratic dimension of it, that there's no difference between my vote and your vote, and also there's no difference between that a celebrity could come from Indiana as much as, you know, Bangalore, India. You know, you can't make the distinction that one celebrity or a celebrity can only emerge from some other form of cultural elite. So that's the democratic element. It is mythic. It's the Hollywood myth. It's the American myth, but it's played out into a very public version of the expression of individuality.
Joshua Gamson, you've also looked at how this culture and fame and celebrity are actually created. What is this celebrity creation?
I wanted to first add in or to pull out a piece of what people are talking about so far, which is the definitional piece. To me, when I'm sort of boiling down what is a celebrity or what is the phenomenon of celebrity, in contemporary times, it has to do with the capacity to attract attention, that's the kind of currency that's being circulated. And that is very much part of, the reason we're talking about it as a media phenomenon is that that capacity to attract attention has monetary value within an industry that uses that. So if I think about people that we're paying attention to now and look at how their attention-getting capacity is being used, we're just talking about, for the most part, the selling of products. And that's the piece that I always focus on.
So that's really this aspect of the celebrity industrial complex.
Yeah, and if you're talking about the definition of celebrity, what is it? Then if it's the capacity to attract attention, then it's the industry that gives that attention value or that makes money from it and gives it financial value.
It sounds like you're saying it's just being turned into another commodity.
I think what's also interesting about it, and Josh identifies that idea of the industrial and the commodity element of it, but it's also that it isn't that as well. It's an emotional relationship that is translatable in terms of cultural value. And I guess that's why I brought up, I guess I've been a lot of writing, but a lot of activity of, say, Angelina Jolie, you could go on and on with the different types of celebrities that have tried to translate that kind of cultural power into something else. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's good, that it's into some notion of activism, but it does mean that it translates sometimes. To use a kind of sociological definition, it moves between cultural fields. So it's possible, that you could have an Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's possible that you could have a Bill Bradley as a basketball player. It's possible that you could have someone who emerges somewhere else and is able to take that kind of cultural economic value, and very much an attention economy captures that, and move it somewhere else. It moves from the commodity itself into something else. As much as it sells the original commodity of the film, it actually becomes a kind of cultural commodity in and of itself that can be moved, or value in and of itself, that can be moved to other realms of society.
This is Josh again. I completely agree with that. And I guess what I'm saying is I think of it as a form of capital. It can be translated into, just like any form of capital or currency, it can be cashed in or translated into another form of capital. So it can become a form of social capital in terms of the networks into which you're, valuable networks in which you're located. It can be a form of political capital. I agree that it's translatable. I mean, under certain conditions, you know, we see that happening all the time.
One of the earlier ones being Barnum, who did create the circus, and how he created celebrity was fascinating. What's the similarity or difference for what Barnum did?
Clearly, there are attempts to build this form of attention-getting capital. And it also is clear that it doesn't always work. But then a whole industry has clearly been built up around the attempt to put attention-getting into a person, so that that person can then be placed in different environments and attract an audience, which can then be sold, so to turn that person into some form of a commodity. The Barnum example is people who are trying to get it to create manufactured events in which they're telling a story about a person which is or isn't true in order to generate interest in that person. So it's the sort of Carnival Barker approach to things. And we still see that now. If I ask my students, if I wanted to be famous, what should I do? They have lots of ideas about the ways that I could be transformed from me, this individual person, into a celebrity who people are interested in, and they would involve taking some piece of me that actually exists and exploding it, creating a whole entire narrative around it, or inventing from whole cloth some other version of me, and then getting sponsorship behind it, getting a machine behind it. So that's all in place, and it's been in place for a long time. Once I'm created, once my story is, my life story is told in an interesting enough way, I can then be placed in other venues as a commodity, used to sell magazines, used to sell something else. That's the attempted process. But the structures of that creative process change a lot, and they've changed recently, and we're seeing new forms of celebrity for that reason.
Let's turn to the psychology element. And David Giles, let's bring you back here. You've talked about both on the celebrity side and also on the fan side what this interaction is. How would you explain this?
To conclude with what Josh was saying about the commodity aspect of celebrity and how that's what I was trying to explain by using the animals as an example. And kind of everything that Josh and David have been saying could be applied to the animals in the paper I wrote recently, such as Knut the polar bear, as in terms of this idea about the capacity to attract attention and being commodified and kind of embodying the emotional aspect, the emotional connection with the audience as well. In response to your question, I mean, the interesting thing about celebrity as in relation to its audience is that this seems to be something which we can trace back through all societies throughout history, which is in the sense of having people that we like to talk about and speculate about and gossip about. And I suppose, again, using a very everyday example of that, the way in which people in a company or a workplace will talk about their boss, and usually their boss is the subject of all sorts of speculation and intense curiosity because they live a little bit apart from the workforce, and they have to kind of maintain this critical distance from them. And in a sense, celebrity is a little bit like that, in that these people who are well-known and are working within what appears to be this sacred space attract this intense curiosity on behalf of the audience or the general public, who obviously want to know more about what they get up to, especially when they're not performing their very visible role as a celebrity, so when they're off stage in their private life. That's very much the kind of psychological appeal of celebrity. And obviously there is this emotional investment that David was talking about that constitutes fandom. But I don't think you have to be a fan of a celebrity to be extremely curious and interested in them. I think we're often just as interested in people who we aren't at all fans of, who we don't even like. And there is something which is, I think, very much one of the phenomena associated with reality TV and other contemporary modes of celebrity, is that very often we're interested in people actually because we don't particularly like them, but we're still necessarily curious about what they get up to when they're not performing on screen or on stage or whatever.
This is Josh. I think that's one of several kinds of identifiable relationships between people who pay attention to celebrities and the people that they're paying attention to, is the gossip that has been around forever, that kind of curiosity about other people's lives. But with celebrities, unlike with your boss, there's no risk that it's ever going to get back to Tom Cruise that I'm gossiping about his sexuality, and there's not going to be any consequence to that activity. I think that turns out to be a kind of productive of gossip. It is more enjoyable, and I think, for most people to gossip when there's not a concern about consequences. So celebrities, because they're not particularly consequential in people's lives, maybe an individual fan relationship is a little bit different, but that sort of generalized talk about people in the public eye, they're inconsequential in most people's lives, and that makes them really good for the kind of conversations that take place through gossip, which tend to be about collective judgments about the morality of people's behaviors, whether somebody is really what they say they are, those kinds of things.
So there are different aspects to what generates this, it sounds like you're saying. One is perhaps what David Giles has written about a bit, which is an actual charisma. But some of it is, this was in Josh's work, about really manipulating attention and manipulating belief. Another piece is just about position. Somebody is the boss, or somebody is put on television. Somebody happens to be the sister of a young woman who married a prince and is pretty.
David Giles, you're quite right. There's different ways of becoming famous. So just as one can become famous because one is just happens to occupy that status of boss or president or whatever, or because you've done something exceptional, if you like, you're a sports performer and you've won some competition, or if you are just someone who is particularly good looking. And in each case, the experiences of celebrity will be slightly different. And so, yes, the pathways to fame or ultimately to celebrity are different. And so there are these diverse experiences across the sector.
David Marshall here. It's also important to see this spectrum in terms of that larger dimension of celebrity and what some writers are using the term kind of micro-celebrity. A recent book by Alice Marwick about Silicon Valley gets very close to saying how that whole tech scene produced a relationship of celebrity in terms of the technological entrepreneur, which is not necessarily what they did as entrepreneurs, but how they presented themselves in that online community in terms of where they were, who they were with, the structure and the relationships that they produced by it, led on to another production of a kind of gossip around them. In some ways, that kind of gossip is between what Josh was describing as, you know, the boss kind of stuff, because this is clearly a community of several hundred thousand potential workers or people who want to rise in a particular area and individuals within that. So it's kind of almost not the same as the structure of this highly mediatized celebrity. But what I think has happened over more or less the last 20 or 30 years is that celebrity culture has actually been, I wouldn't call it democratized, but has been played out in a lot of environments, including fan environments. People who are closer to the star are actually given an aura of celebrity because they have some insight into what's happening with a particular star within a fan community. So one of the things that I've been looking at most recently is the translation of a celebrity culture into a wider culture, mainly through online dimensions. And through that, it becomes something that is not just us watching in a fan-like way, but actually becomes a consciousness of how influence is constructed much more than it ever has in the past. So it's a translation that we are in a sense, almost by online culture, mediatized, maybe not at the same level as we've seen in the highly mediated television, radio, film world, but still operating at the level of Facebook worlds and the crossover between those. To give you an example of that, Scott Willis, Demi Moore's and Bruce Willis's daughter, is 22 years old and has gone on this crusade of making breasts visible. And Instagram blocked it, and Twitter allowed the images to sort of come from Scott Willis. Now, she's nowhere near a major celebrity, but her action produced a kind of flurry of all sorts of activities by making a kind of statement. So she emerges from a status of meta-celebrity into something else, but also nowhere near anything that you would say that millions are watching.
It seems like that's the kind of celebrity that's developed by challenging a norm.
Mm, that's true. That's out there a lot, whether it was Lenny Bruce or in comedy, or whether it's Evel Knievel going over Snake River Canyon. A sad celebrity in some ways.
I imagine in order to have this culture where we have celebrities and then we have everybody else, you have to have two other aspects. One is a participant who is willing to be the celebrity, or in the case of the animals, probably don't even realize they're the celebrities. Then the other aspect is, what does this kind of mean for society, for politics, for democracy, for these kinds of other ideals that we talk about? David Giles, let's go back to you for a moment. You're our psychologist. You've studied the psychology on both sides of this, including the celebrities themselves and the kind of almost addictive nature there is to being very famous.
Well, it's certainly addictive in the sense that it's a life-changing experience to become a celebrity, undoubtedly the case for anyone who's experienced it. But of course, one of the things that comes with celebrity is the need to maintain it. It's like buying a new car or a pet or something that you obviously have to keep it going. And that is sometimes extremely difficult if your celebrity is founded on something that is not particularly easy to recreate. I mean, we've talked before about some of the things that people become famous for, such as bucking a trend or acting against the norm. So we had this example of Scott Willis that David mentioned. Now, okay, making breasts visible might be a good means of keeping your celebrity status going for a short while. But people will become bored with your breasts, I imagine, after a little bit. And at that
speak point, for yourself, David.
Well, I've never seen Scott Willis's breasts, so I can't possibly judge that one. But the problem is, whatever it is that makes you famous in the first place doesn't always endure. And obviously, if you've done something, if you're a sports performer, this is an example of meritocratic fame, because in a sense, a sports performer is invariably only as good as their performances on the field, unless they are able to as we mentioned before, we talked about different fields that you can move into. And I suppose one of the things that celebrities are often encouraged to do is to seek other fields to move into. But your success in those other fields is often very difficult to guarantee, unless you really are multi-talented, or you have such a high level of celebrity that you can't possibly fail. So what we find is that sometimes people who get this very instantaneous burst of celebrity that puts them in the public eye for a short period, for example, appearing in a reality TV show, often find that that very intense experience vanishes very quickly afterwards. This can be extremely difficult to cope with, because if you're seeking celebrity, if you're seeking fame and recognition, then it's serving an important psychological function for you. But if you can't maintain it, if you lose it, then it's quite a traumatic experience to have to cope with. That is a very difficult thing for a lot of people. And even people who are very talented and have built a really good bedrock for their continuing celebrity can struggle once they perhaps have some difficulties in their personal life that make it harder to function as a celebrity, and they succumb to various temptations, drugs, alcohol, and so on. They mess around with their relationships, and those people also, even if they don't actually lack the talent to keep their celebrity going, if their personal life suffers as a result, then sometimes that can also be an added difficulty to have to deal with. And we have a good example in Britain of famous footballer Paul Gascoigne. I don't know how well known he might be stateside, but he was one of the most famous people in Britain in 1990, in the early 90s. but he's now really quite a sad figure because he became addicted to alcohol. He suffered various mental health problems, and now the only time he's in the media is when being checked into another secure unit for therapy. And so this is a guy who was very talented, but despite his attempts to move into another field, he tried a bit of football management, a bit of coaching, but it didn't work because of his ongoing personal problems. And yes, it is a very, celebrity, a very fragile thing to have to try and cope with in the long run.
One of your interviewees in your piece said he'd been addicted to every substance known to man, and the most addicting was fame. So when you lose that, it does seem like maybe he would have to fill it with something else.
Yes, certainly if you sought it out in the first place to fulfill a need. But of course, the thing, one of the things about addictions is that, very often the word addiction is used in a metaphorical sense, in that we believe we can't live without it. And I think one of the things that can perhaps ease the passage for many celebrities is people who can keep them grounded in some way. And I think one of the ways they can do that is to develop a much more realistic relationship with, or understanding really, of how media work and how their own, you know, in a sense, how fragile their own celebrity is right from the word go. And I think one of the problems is it's very hard for people to disassociate the media coverage from their own personal qualities and believe that they're famous because of who they are, rather than actually because, as we've been saying earlier, they produce something that's temporarily commercially desirable, you know?
Just a reminder that this is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the celebrity industrial complex and its effect on society. Stay tuned. Let's take this into the broader context of what all this means really for society. It's been a few years now, but we had that whole Occupy movement railing against the 1%. And many of the people who are enduring celebrities are, of course, part of the so-called 1%. It still creates a sort of privileged class in everybody else. Joshua Gamson, I'm going to bring you in because you did a lot of citing of Neil Postman's work dealing with amusing ourselves to death. What are the implications of all this?
The thing that you're saying about the 1% may be a slightly separate thing. I mean, it's just a question of what is the impact of having elites of any kind that are super privileged, and this is one element of that. Economic elites, and they're a sort of cultural and economic elite without political power. That's one set of questions, and then there's the question about, does this phenomenon do damage society-wide? And so we've already talked about some of the potential damage of having and losing celebrity as a famous person. But, you know, there's also a lot of complaint about the impact of celebrity culture on the society in general, sort of ways in which it's pathological for the society. So, for instance, that what you basically have is a system in which people are distracted by trivial stories of people who don't matter from the things that do matter more deeply in a society, inequality, you know, bigger life questions and so on. That's one possibility, and I think there is a lot of that going on, but it's not even the only pitch from the industry that we should be admiring of these people and interested in them and even identified with them. The industry doesn't require a lot of reverence for the people that are supposedly above us in this celebrity stratosphere. It operates perfectly well with people gossiping about people they don't care about or don't like or don't identify with. So to me, the starting point is always, what are people doing with this cultural material? And some people are doing pathological things with it. They are distracting themselves from things that, if they weren't distracted by celebrities, they would be focused on deeper problems. They are identifying with people who are providing bad or superficial role models. So, you know, there is some of that. I worry about it with my kids. You know, my daughter in a supermarket asked me who Casper was. I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. Turns out it's J-Lo's boyfriend, and she knew they were breaking up. And I was thinking, do I want her to be relating to celebrity culture in such a, as though it's this real thing in her life and she should be looking up to see what J-Lo is doing and so on? That's all the one side of it. On the other side of it, people are having a lot of other kinds of conversations and doing a lot of other kinds of activities that don't seem particularly pathological to me and actually seem useful for the society. One of the things that people do a lot when they're talking about celebrities is talk about the difference between the image and what might be behind that image. So even at the level, at the very common and superficial level of, you know, just asking if you've met somebody, what are they really like, or commenting that they're shorter, which they always seem to be shorter in person, that kind of thing is still about distinguishing between an image that you know is being manufactured for your consumption and what might be behind that. That kind of conversation in a society like ours, where we are being approached pretty constantly, at least through media, with a pitch, with, like, you know, this is a person you should vote for, this is a person you should buy, and so on and so forth. There's a lot of BS to contend with. And so I think it's a pretty productive thing for people to be, have an opportunity to constantly practice detecting the BS that's around them.
David Marshall.
It's complicated, and I would agree with all the pathologies that are there that can happen, that can distract people. But I think the larger dimension is probably related back to Josh's notion of how it transforms a culture in terms of value. In other words, that we see this pattern of attention, this pattern of trying to produce influence as being ultimately more important than some of the other things that we do, more important than what David Giles talked about in terms of fame can come from doing something significant. And that we, as a culture, we move to something about attention itself being ultimately more valuable than some other activities. So the danger with Josh's daughter is to also get confused about what is valuable in their own lives. So, you know, there have been lots of surveys and lots of surveys of young people where it's pointed out where they see becoming famous as being valuable in and of itself. In these surveys, they can't really say what it is that they are famous for, but the idea of fame itself becomes valuable, or the idea of a celebrity status becomes valuable. So that's one sort of level, a cultural level of change that I'm saying is also occurring and being manifest, in a sense, in online culture and the way it attracts attention. That attracting of attention is actually fed back into the commodity system because our online culture makes us expose ourselves. In the same way as celebrity culture is a lot about exposure, we now have generalized that in a sense of a large, large portion of our lives being exposed. So I think that's a consequence of the power of celebrity culture.
Even in the sense of the meritocratic areas, say you're a great athlete, for example, I think that was the one, David Giles, you mentioned. But even in these ideas of meritocracy, where somebody's just good at what they do, we've celebritized certain fields, like it's more important to be a great football player than it is to be a great scientist.
That is true, that we have presented that hierarchy, which doesn't make any sense. The reward to play football seems out of proportion, other than that we know that the television rights or other rights that go to the actual team that the football star is attached to makes it economically sensible that the person who attracts that attention should get a fairly large proportion of what comes in. At the same time, I suppose that may or may not be the case. What I would say is that this generalization is actually shaping and shifting more professions than we really imagine. That we think it's part of entertainment culture, but it's definitely part of political culture in terms of that notion of attention. But it's probable, and this is the area that I'm looking at now, that we're also constructing this notion of attention in medicine, in law, in probably the areas that you're talking about in terms of science. And we see it very visibly. I think David and Josh would agree with me that there is a bit of that, quite a bit of that, even in the academic sphere, about how attention is attracted to certain academics in a certain way.
You can't see me nodding, but I'm nodding.
Is driven by that same notion of what a certain author that studies celebrity calls residual value, that extra value that is beyond the activity itself. Now, I wanted to say one other thing, which is a little bit different than that, a little bit of a change in certain things that identifies a larger cultural value with celebrity. When I wrote my first book on this, I talked about that there was something about celebrity culture that actually attached to other powerful political dimensions. And the key one is, and Josh has got close to it, is that it identifies an opening up of the personal is political. And if everyone knows that phrase, it definitely comes from women's liberation, second-generation feminism. And there's something about what celebrity identifies, which is that it thinks of the personal, the intimate, as a pathway to a better world, a better culture. Because, as Josh was describing, it gets us to take apart image and look at it really closely. The interesting thing is I've been recently drawn to Hannah Arendt's work about what she imagined as public and private, and lamented, in a sense, that we had allowed too much, even though she wasn't writing about it, we've allowed too much of the private to enter our public discourse. So where Josh was describing how we might get distracted by all this other stuff, celebrity Rihanna, as opposed to looking at the politics of what's happening in our backyards, and, you know, the 1% controlling too much of, you know, politics and economy, is that we are moving into a world where we've allowed the intimate to maybe have too much of a say in our public discourse. And that's where celebrity culture is really interesting. Have we gone too far in this idea that it's a revelation that helps us in a political sense, in a cultural sense? Have we gone too far in seeing that this public discourse of intimacy, whether it's reality television, whether it's and its versions of celebrity, is going too far in distracting? And so I think what's emerging is a weird notion that because of our wider awareness across, because of, in some ways, online culture, we're aware of this attention economy, that things are beginning to shift again, that we're also becoming aware of the lines of public and private way more than we have in past decades and past centuries.
Joshua Gamson.
So I really like what David Marshall is saying. I just think some of the disturbing aspects of what's been happening, he put his finger on, the kind of shrinking of private life, the constant encouragement to expose, and the value shift where attention itself becomes the goal, and I've seen that a lot. What I wanted to add is that, and I think, David, this is maybe what you were saying towards the end of your comments, is that there's a certain insight in the fact that people are valuing attention. Like when my daughter says, and she's 8, when she says, you know, well, I want to be famous because then we'll have a lot of money and this is what we can do with it. She's, you know, in a very rudimentary 8-year-old way, recognizing the structure that's in front of her, that attention itself is valuable in a marketplace. So there's a correct seeing of the structure, even at that level, that's happening, which makes it even more disturbing to me, because this is structural. You are getting rewarded for the exposure of intimate life, and in fact, even, you know, all of the online exposure of self that's so constant, in addition to reality TV, just the constant online on Vine, the kinds of videos that people are creating, the showing of your, you know, of body parts on Snapchat, and all of that kind of exposure, that's the way in to this attention economy. That's the way in without having a publicist. And it works. For a lot of people, it works. So it's very hard to imagine how you could get out of that cycle. And I guess I'm kind of waiting for the backlash. I actually do think it's coming, but, you know, we'll see. I'm a terrible prognosticator. But the backlash to the sense that what we should be pursuing is attention, and the way of getting that attention should be the exposure of our intimate selves and our intimate lives constantly, and that there's so little room left for people to be, how do I put it, alone and unwatched.
David Giles.
I think Josh has hit the nail on the head there in the sense of visibility. And interestingly, to see if there would be a backlash, but my feeling is that maybe it wouldn't be so much a backlash as a sort of gradual dissolution of celebrity, in the sense that we've entered a potential new era for fame. Talked at the beginning of the discussion about how we agreed that we could identify celebrity as sort of mass media phenomenon that gradually emerged with the spread of media from newspapers onto Hollywood, onto TV, and then onto the internet. But of course, what we've got now is this shrinking on one level and expansion on the other, which is how young people in particular are becoming socialized into a world in which they are themselves part of the same media. They're no longer just consumers, and they're producing themselves as these micro-celebrities. I think David mentioned earlier this concept of micro-celebrity, so that now almost all my students will have their profile on Facebook or possibly on Twitter as well, with hundreds of so-called friends who've attached themselves to them, and they're living out a very visible existence in terms of the number of pictures and movies and so on that they've uploaded. I mean, it's always possible that eventually this might be enough to be a micro-celebrity. That's more, I mentioned before, that you've just got this incredible multiplication of celebrities now where there are so many it's almost impossible to keep up. And maybe we'll reach a saturation point at some stage where we eventually are content just to be a celebrity within our own social media circle, as it were, because that's enough attention and that's enough recognition. I don't know when that point would come, but you know, it's just another form of celebrity, perhaps, that could even supersede the current one.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Joshua Gamson is professor of sociology at the University of San Francisco and the author of Claims to Fame, Celebrity in Contemporary America. David Marshall is chair of New Media, Communication and Cultural Studies at Deakin University in Australia. He's the author of Celebrity and Power, Fame in Contemporary Culture, New Media Cultures, and The Celebrity Culture Reader. David Giles is a professor of media psychology at the University of Winchester in the UK. He's author of Illusions of Immortality, A Psychology of Fame and Celebrity, and Psychology of the Media. Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Kwatemok Aleman, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Armudian. See you next week.